Good morning, everyone. Today, our speaker for Personal Theology is Jacob King. We're very pleased to host him today. Jacob is a first-year student at Starking School for the Ministry, and he is a veteran. And he is working on becoming a military chaplain for the Oregon National Guard. He's going to talk today on the seven principles of the UU Church and what they mean to him from a soldier's perspective. So I'm going to turn it over to you now, Jacob. Thank you for being here.
Thank you, Anne. It's a pleasure to be here, everyone. I think this invitation for this meeting went out about 2 months ago. I'm in a UU history class with some of you might be familiar with her, Professor Meg Richardson. She's a historian and scholar within the UUA and UU faith community. But they had sent out a request asking for Starking students to share what they view as the UU values and their interpretation. And it looks like when I discussed with Matthew Waterman, he works with the Starking School for the Ministry board, he asked me to come and speak with you guys. And I even spoke with him before I agreed to it. It didn't make sense for me to sit here and do my interpretation of just the seven values without any context of where my interpretation of the values came from. You know, we all can read the values the way they are written, and Lonnie will pull them up at some point during the discussion.
Oops.
Sorry, cat stepped on my keyboard. But without understanding my upbringing, where I came from, and as the title says, the soldier's perspective, it would just be me reading it word for word what the values say, which my personal interpretation of the UU values is what's guiding me throughout schooling, seminary, and what I'm going to carry with me throughout the military chaplaincy. And before I begin, I just wanted to ask Lucinda, where exactly is your son located in Afghanistan? You're muted.
He's in the Marine Corps, and he just left for deployment, is on a ship someplace.
Nice. He won't be on there long.
Heading across the Pacific.
Yeah, there's a saying in the Marines that a ship without Marines is like a suit without buttons. So is it his first deployment?
Second deployment. It'll be about an 8 month. He left just recently left.
Last week.
Okay. So he'll probably spend 4 months on the ship, 3 months on ground, and then a month coming back. So, but I hope for his safety. Afghanistan region is currently we might be pulling troops out, but it is not de-escalating the conflict by any means. It's actually quite the opposite. I don't know if anyone's ever seen a overview map of Afghanistan, but a reference is there's a giant highway that goes through the country in a giant circle called the Ring Road. And it's the main transportation and supply chain throughout the country. And there's different groups that claim ownership of the Ring Road, and not all those groups are representative of the Afghan government. And so it's a tough situation, many groups fighting, and that's why there's been a war going on for so long. But hopefully he'll come home safely, I know.
Thank you.
All right. So for the seven values, so I guess we'll start in the beginning and a little overview of me. So as you're aware, my name is Jacob King. I was born in Omaha, Nebraska. I lived there for 20 years of my life. I just saw Anne do jazz hands. So either she's familiar with jazzercise or she knows a little bit about Nebraska. I was raised in a single parent household with my father and two brothers. One of my brothers are looking at joining the Marines in the few years when he graduates high school. And the other one is slacking on putting his application in for the Guard, but I'm sure he'll get around to it at some point. I've been a member of the National Guard for the last 6 years. I first enlisted in 2015. I have deployed once and am a veteran, and I've gone on numerous missions throughout the Guard. As besides deployments, the Guard is responds to all sorts of crisis within our country. Most recently, I got to participate in the COVID response, delivering medical supplies throughout the southern area of Oregon with masks. People in the southern Oregon area are fairly conservative. And so the first day we were there, we had the cops called on us because people thought we were, I don't know why, they were afraid that the Guard was there. But when it came out that we were giving away free stuff, everyone got really excited. So that got the delayed the law enforcement response for a little bit. With that, so I've been a member of the UU faith for approximately 2 years. I was raised Christian. When I, on my 18th birthday, as soon as I left for the service, I kind of don't necessarily know if left the faith is a good word, but I stopped going to church after that. Even when I was deployed, I still studied the Bible and other faiths, but I didn't go to any services per se. The next time I walked into a UU church was 2 years ago, and it led to this journey of pursuing seminary, but we'll get to there towards the end. So my early life in growing up in Nebraska was tumultuous. When I was 6 years old, my family had an incident with my mother, who had a history of substance abuse. And as many of you know, substance abuse isn't a one-time thing. It can take over the course of 10 years. And when my father first met my mother, she was clean. But as you're aware, the cycle of addiction is a vicious cycle. And so from 6 to 8, I was living in a foster care facility, which helped inspire my initial foray into wanting to help people, because I was bouncing from house to house, place to place. Not all the houses were very well. I wasn't treated very well at some of them. There was history of abuse and sexual abuse that I didn't feel comfortable sharing until 20 years later to a military ordered counselor. But that experience helped shape my initial ministry. Now it does, especially because I have that context and reference of knowing what it's like to go through that cycle of abuse. Growing up, my father joined the service in 2004. His first mission was to Hurricane Katrina. As many of you are aware, that was a terrible incident. It required guard support for 2 months to help rebuild the areas that were completely destroyed by the tsunami. My father also ended up getting deployed during the Afghan surge of 2010 and the Iraq surge of 2012. So for 2 to 3 years of my life, I was living, as I mentioned, I came from a single parent household. So when the military doesn't deploy single soldiers anymore, but at that time they did. And so it was up to the soldier being told to deploy to figure out what to do with their kids. So the first time he managed to find my uncle. And so I got to live in the country for a little bit. And that during that time, I was going to church. I was going to a nice rural church if any of you have got the privilege of going to go to a rural church. It's kind of like our UU coffee hour, but throughout the entire service. It's in a small town of couple hundred people, church is the main thing of the week. It's the gathering, it's the community coming together, able to share their joys and sorrows throughout the week. That's been one of the things during the pandemic that I've missed, is the UU coffee hour, because I know many of us, it's the same thing. We're living busy lives during the week, and getting to come together, talk with friends, decompress, it's hard to do during a Zoom format, but hopefully that will change, because I know we're all excited with the new vaccine being developed in courtesy of Germany. The second deployment when my father deployed to Iraq was really difficult on my brother and I. The Afghan surge was less stressful as he was lucky enough to be put stationed on bases that were relatively safe. But during the Iraq surge, the mission plan, you can use the term generally, the plan they had, the best idea was instead of keeping soldiers in the safety of bases, they were just sending soldiers out on poorly planned patrols along roadways where we've all seen movies such as The Hurt Locker, driving on a road with poor planning in an area like Iraq where IEDs are commonplace was a terrible, terrible mission planning. And so my father lost many of his friends while traveling. And there were many times where we would see the news of roadside bomb or IED go off. And it was always in the back of your mind of, was my father on that convoy? Was my father on that road? And luckily he didn't get directly injured, but there was two close calls where one time one of the vehicles in front of him got hit by an IED. And so that's a difference of 20 feet where if he had gone just 20 feet further, that would have been him. And then one of the missions, he called us back because someone had taken a shot at the vehicle and he was driving and the bullet lodged right into the window, right where his head was. So it was like the windows are mainly bulletproof, but when you're traveling 80 miles per hour against a bullet, it actually increases the velocity of the bullet going through the glass. So it was a difference of mere inches that he survived. As many of you are aware, the military VA has only recently been expanding its understanding of what PTSD means. I didn't notice it so much on the first deployment, but the second deployment, my father came back a changed man. It was almost like he was still joyful, but it was two stressful deployments. And he was about 34 at the time. And he had left for the second deployment with black hair, and he had come back with partial balding and white hair. And my uncle even pointed it out to me that at that time that there was something missing from him, something that he had left in country. I don't know if it was losing so many close friends or coming so close to death, but his coming home was, they brought him back. He spent a week in Texas and they sent him back home. There was no real decompression period. He didn't even get seen by a counselor. It was just sign these paperwork, turn in the gear we issued you and go home. And as we're aware, that's why veteran suicide is so high. It's because we send these soldiers back with no period of reflection or talking about what happened. We just send them back to their families. I think during World War II, there's a study that showed that there was less PTSD from World War II versus Vietnam, not necessarily because the wars were more terrible than one or the other, but because, not due to any intentional design, soldiers were forced to spend 2 weeks on a ship coming back home from Europe. And during that time, we're able to talk among with each other because there's nothing else to do for 2 weeks on a barge. And that decompression period just helped people get through their trauma and the horrors they experienced, where with my father, they didn't give him that. He had always grown up a Christian, but after his second deployment, we stopped going to church. It was kind of a weird 2 year period. And then he also started, he was angrier than usual. He had never taken to alcohol, but he started drinking. He had never taken to smoking, but he started smoking. We were young. We were only 11 to 12, living with a single father, and he was our caretaker, our caregiver, but we didn't know how we could help him. We weren't in that, we weren't developed enough ourselves to be able to help him get treatment. And there was a, it was a tough for a couple of years, because as the alcohol stopped working and the cigarette stopped working, he started to take it out on my brother and I. He was more quick to anger, abusive, more prone to hitting. And it was tough for my brother and I, because we were about 13 or and 11 at the time, because we knew what was causing him this discomfort, but we didn't know where else to turn. We knew he wasn't a terrible person. We knew he wasn't a terrible man, a terrible father, but there was no treatment available. And it wasn't until we were about 14 that finally a friend of his recommended him to try a new church. And from there, we started going to this new church called a Life Church. It was a Christian church, and it was taking place in a high school. They had to rent the balcony each week because they didn't have the funds for a full church. But despite the locale not being a formal church setting, I think the first time we went, there was 200 people packed into the school auditorium pre-COVID. So not as, would definitely not be allowed now, but this was 2006, 2007. But going there, getting them into a faith with other individuals, even the pastor himself, the pastor was a Native American who had served in Vietnam. And he talked about his story as well, of they brought him home from Vietnam after he had witnessed all his friends die and had done horrible deeds that he considered atrocious. And he was given a week of rest, turned in all his gear, and sent back to his reservation with no treatment, no guidance, and no, he got a GI Bill that he didn't even know how to use or how to sign up for, because there was no VA education helpline like there is now. And it was a similar story for him, of he turned to substance abuse, alcohol abuse, drug abuse. And he was, when the pastor was 26 years old, he was passed out in the middle of a street after a night of drinking, and a Christian chaplain that had been visiting the reservation almost hit him with his car, and got him picked up, pulled him out of the roadway, had some salts with him, got him woke up, and the pastor said he popped up with a wide look in his eyes and said, who the hell are you? And he's like, the chaplain responded, well, no one, who are you? And the two hit it off from there. And within 3 years, this Native American Vietnam vet, who for all intents and purposes could have died getting hit by a car, got his degree in theology and now is preaching. And his message as a vet connected with my father, and my father's substance abuse went down, his alcohol abuse went down, and I don't think he ever truly recovered what he lost going overseas, because that part of him is still locked up and he still hasn't sought treatment for that. But it goes to show that with faith organizations and even our faith, we serve a tool that modern counseling, it's like a gap that can't be filled. It's a void that is missing something. We have all these counseling treatments available. The VA spends $30 billion a year on counseling programs, and yet there's still many vets that don't seek the programs or aren't able to get to the programs or any other excuse in the book. And yet we have proof time and time again of vets coming to faith-based organizations for help and healing and leaving away, walking away with hope, with help, with community support, because we all know that the U.S. government has had many failings in its treatment of veterans, and we know that they've agreed to give their all to their country, and so we're able to fulfill that need that is currently not being fulfilled. And many vets, thanks to faith-based organizations, do get that professional counseling treatment that they need, we just edge them closer to the door. And that's what the UU did for me. Taking inspiration from my father, as soon as I turned 18, I joined the service. My school counselor called me in, and there was a couple teachers in the room because they had put me in for a college scholarship without my knowing, as I was very involved in schooling. I was always getting good grades. I was involved with programs, and it was many of you might have heard it before. It's called the Buffett Scholarship, courtesy of Warren Buffett and the Berkshire Hathaway Foundation. They offer a full-time scholarship to any of the local Nebraska state colleges, and I had unwittingly received it. I did not expect to get it by any means, and they asked me if I was going to stop going through with my services. Why would I need to go through the service at that point? Your college is paid for. You can start school 3 months from now. Why bother going to a service where you could possibly die? And I went home that night with that weighing on the back of my mind of, what am I doing here? Isn't that the only goal here, is to get the college paid for? That's what all the recruiters say, is you get your school paid for. That's what I hear other people say, is you get your school paid for. And I called my recruiter that night and told him about the scholarship. And he was like, okay, well, I guess I can just go ahead and cancel your enlistment. And I said, no. I just wanted to tell you that I'm still going through with it. Even though the schooling was paid for and that was a nice benefit, I didn't sign the dotted line solely for school paid for. I was inspired by my father, by my family. I've grown up in this nation and it's had its faults, but it's been very good to me. And I really wanted to serve. I wanted to give back to my community that gave it its all. And so I signed up as a 11 Bravo infantryman, which that gave me the ability to go to airborne school. And I lied about having a fear of heights, and within 2 weeks I was falling out of perfectly good airplanes. I was not doing that again. A couple 4 weeks after I came back, I was scheduled to start college classes. And I was walking to my first class. I was so excited. I just spent 6 months of basic training, going through the toughest training I've ever gone through. I was excited to start schooling. And I got a phone call from a sergeant that I had never met before. And he said, turn on the news. And I said, okay. Turned on the news. This was 2016, and Mosul had just fallen to ISIS. And the CNN was showing a video of a group of children being massacred by ISIL fighters for no other reason than they wanted to get control. And the sergeant was watching the same feed I was, and he was like, you see that? And I said, yes. And he was like, come to this address 3 days from now, you're being deployed to Iraq. And this was right after I had started schooling. And so I dropped everything, all my classes. The University of Nebraska Omaha has a veteran center that was very understanding. And after spending 3 months in Fort Riley training, I was on the ground in Kuwait and Iraq, ready to serve. It was very fast turnaround. For reference, when you join the National Guard, most people join the Guard with the intent not to deploy. It's easy to get out of doing missions, but most people, if they do deploy, it's like 4 years in, where I had been back from training for less than a few weeks and was already getting deployed, with hoping that all the training they had given me was enough. The first 6 months I spent overseas was in Kuwait. The mission, due to the nature of the war, was really rushed in its planning. The Army had spent the last 5 years pulling troops out of Iraq and Kuwait. And so when we got there, we were basically responsible for building up all these abandoned facilities that hadn't been used in 4 to 5 years, which, if any of you have been to the desert, know that desert sands are not very nice to un, unkept buildings. And so we were sweeping sand out of them, trying to rebuild doors. The first 6 months of my deployment, I was told that I was going to be the liaison NCO for the 1st Infantry Division, which for any military members here, the liaison NCO is the person you meet when you come into a country, and they also help get you to the other country you're going to. And usually that role is reserved for someone that has been in the military for 20 years and is a first sergeant or sergeant major. And they gave that task to me and another soldier who had only been in for a year, mainly because they didn't know where else to put people. The mission was rushed and it's planning. And so my goal was to tell people whether they were going over to this country or going over to that country, working with people way above my rank. The phone in my desk would ring every day with people from branches I wasn't in long enough to know what a corps meant or what a division meant. And I'm getting calls from people with a star on their chest, meaning general, asking which country is 2nd Corps going to. And I respond, "I don't even know what a corps is, sir," which is not the response someone that has got a star on their chest likes to hear. And my leadership got some angry phone calls from that. Wasn't any fault of mine, but I was a brand new soldier. I didn't know what I was doing. The weird thing I noticed throughout Kuwait, though, is because of the rushed nature, there was a lax in discipline. And if any of you are familiar with military history, things like especially sieges are prone to military units losing discipline. And when this discipline gets lost and people get bored, criminal activities can occur. And throughout the area we were in, there wasn't a really high military police presence. And so within 2 to 3 months of being there, I remember hearing the scream and the sirens go off in the middle of the night as a female soldier was found in one of the bathrooms that had just been raped by a soldier on the base. This was like, we'd been there for 2 months, and it took some digging, but they managed to find the person who did it. But it was like, what are we doing here? Where is this? What is our purpose? We just got thrown into this without any general plan. And now a female soldier who, through no fault of their own, used the restroom in the middle of the night, now has her entire life is going to be scarred, and her entire understanding of what the service means to her ruined. By the 3rd or 4th month, this discipline did not continue to deteriorate. And many of the officers and NCOs that were given authority over soldiers did not have any real background checks done on them. When I was working in the NCO liaison office, I was working the night shift because my friend and I blocked it off 12 hours. He worked 12 hours during the day, I worked 12 hours during the night. And I noticed soldiers coming in more and more because I took an IT course at the start of the deployment while in Kuwait, because they train all the Army's radio men there. And so I just walked into one of the courses there. And though I'm an infantryman, no one said anything, because I wanted to fix the printer. And so 3 months into the deployment, the Army hadn't sent any IT specialists. And so I was the only one with a working printer on the base I was at. And so people started to come in during the middle of the night. And it kind of turned into an impromptu coffee shop. People were coming in during the middle of the night because they knew that's when it was the least busy, and would just come in and print dozens of documents, whatever task they were doing. And I was sitting at a desk. I didn't really have anything to do during the night. And so people would just talk to me. And they would tell me what's going on, all the problems they were having. And it was, as this discipline started to deteriorate, the stories that were coming to me were more and more hard to hear. I was hearing of indications of racism, people, Black African-American soldiers being called the N-word by their officers and NCOs, people being hazed, which hazed means being smoked unlawfully. There was abuse going on. There was misuse of power and authority. People going off, NCOs checking out vehicles to go off base and like illegally. And people were telling me these stories during this time. And I've been in the Army for like a year and 3 months. I still don't know what's right and what's, well, I knew what's right and what's wrong, but I don't know how to respond to these, because I don't know what regulation to reference as the wrongdoing. They didn't give me any of that training. They just have me sitting here at this desk. And so the best I could do was just rely on the Christian upbringing and just talk with people. I think I couldn't solve their issues per se at that moment in time, but I could at least talk with them. There was one incident, however, where I definitely intervened. Of a soldier kept coming to me and was telling me about how he wasn't sleeping because he reported his NCO for doing an illegal action. And so that NCO's response was to give him extra duty during his time for sleep. So he was already working 14 hours, and then his extra duty would be scheduled 2 hours after that. And so he would get an hour nap, do the extra duty, and get maybe an hour or two nap before his work day. As many of you are aware, that's unsustainable for a long period of time. So by the second month, he was telling me how he was thinking about killing himself, which I could not stand by and allow that to happen. And so I helped him. I told him to go ask his leadership to go, if he can go seek the legal office, because that's what we were told to do. And the leadership told him to screw off. So I had my own vehicle, being an LNO. So I took him to the legal office. And my leadership's response for me sending him to the legal office was they picked a base in Iraq that was getting mortared once a day. And they said, go there and don't come back. They weren't saying don't come back as in don't come back during this deployment. They were saying don't come back as an eternal warning. So within 3 days of taking him to the legal office, I was sent to Iraq. And Iraq was even worse than Kuwait, not necessarily because of the risk, but this discipline due to an unplanned mission. Within my first few days there, I was witnessing firsthand open sexual abuse, sexual harassment, gender, like abusing, openly verbally abusing of female soldiers by male NCOs. And I was working in this office for 12 hours a day with this NCO who almost every shift he was like openly watching porn, openly talking about soldiers in a sexual manner. He kept like asking me sexual references, and I was like, I don't want any part of that. You can go into your office and do whatever. I'm just going to do my work here. And I think they've talked about in sexual assault, this grooming. And during my 4 months there, I think this is what this NCO was doing, is he was grooming me every day. He was trying to test a little bit more, saying like, hey, do you have any pictures of yourself? Or, hey, look at these abs that I just worked out with. Like, minor things that he had made like culturally acceptable, because that's how his personality was. Everyone knew that, oh, that's the guy, that he's just that way, don't pay him any mind. And it wasn't until 3 months later when I walked into the shower after shift, and he was trying to lure me into one of the shower cells, and I pushed him off, that it became, that was the point for me of, okay, I gotta do something about this. But I didn't get that initial chance. He was clearly upset about being pushed away. And so he made up some fib that I had left my post, which, if many of you are aware, in the military, you can do a lot of illegal actions and the military will turn a blind eye. But leaving your post in World War I was considered grounds for execution. And it's a very big deal. And so for 10 hours, all the leadership in the base, who many of them were aware he was lying, but they hazed the hell out of me. They had me running around this base, which around that time in Iraq, it's 110 degrees. So running around outside was not conducive to human health. They had me doing all sorts of extra duty push-ups. And I knew that it was wrong that it was an illegal order, but at the same time, I wasn't going to let this break me. I had been through worse training, but finally to end it off, they had me doing like flutter kicks for like an hour. And when it was all said and done, they sent me to my room. I didn't feel comfortable going back to the showers because I didn't know if he was still there. So I'm just laying in my bed with all the sweat and grime of running around in the middle of this sand pit. And I remember like sitting there with, by once my heart rate got down, I realized that I couldn't move my legs anymore. My lower spine was extremely damaged and I fell asleep, obviously from being so tired. And when I woke up, I tried to get out of my bed and I fell face first from my bunk, top of the bunk to the floor, and I realized I couldn't move my legs immediately. It took me about 20 minutes to get up off the floor. And I wasn't given any other details than to just report to my normal work like nothing had happened just then. I wasn't given any formal counseling paperwork, which is illegal in the Army. It was just the hazing, and I didn't want to give them the satisfaction that they had wounded me. So I grimaced and braced through the pain and shuffled my way to my workspace half a mile away, ignoring the pain. By the third day, I realized that there might have been some severe damage because the pain wasn't stopping. So I managed to sneak out, go to a medical professional nearby, and the doctor looked at me for like 30 minutes. He's like, "What the hell happened to you?" And I told him what was happened, and he stepped out for a minute and said, "All right, I need you to go to the IG office." And I'm like, "What's the IG office?" "The Inspector General." I'm like, "What's an Inspector General?" And he's like, "Haven't they ever briefed you on this before?" And I was like, "No." And I told him about the assault experience in the shower. And he's like, "Well, you need to go to the Sharp Advocate." And I'm like, "What's a Sharp Advocate?" "Sexual harassment and response personnel for reporting sexual assaults." And I didn't even know what that was. I didn't know where on the base to go. And he's like, "Didn't they ever brief you this?" And I was like, "No, they didn't care. It didn't really matter to the people at the top of this mission. Their only goal was to do whatever, have a 9-month fun and debauchery." But the doctor got me hooked up with those office representatives. I managed to type up a quite long 30-page document on the sexual assault and a 50-page document on everything that I had witnessed in the LNO office and firsthand accounts to soldiers. And within 2 weeks, there were individuals coming down from the Pentagon and local military agencies to figure out what the hell is going on this deployment. By the end of it, though, that first 2 weeks, the only person that was in trouble was the NCO that sexually harassed people, mainly because he had sexually harassed a family member of a high-ranking colonel. Otherwise, he wouldn't have got any punishment. But his punishment was he lost half a month's pay and he got a ding on his record, which he had already, he had 20 years in and was going to retire after the mission anyway. So it wasn't anything real conducive. The other soldiers I had reported, that was a entirely different matter. They tell you in the Army that you can safely report these people without any reprisal. And then they tell you that if you get reprisal as a whistleblower, they'll be there to help you. What they don't say is that the help doesn't come immediately. So after I got back, they sent me back to Kuwait because they didn't want me to come back, stay in Iraq and report anyone else. And when I got back to Kuwait, the command staff were upset that I came back to Kuwait in one piece. And so the extra duty continued and I just continued to jot everything down because they were still harassing people. The soldier that had almost committed suicide and had to go for 3 weeks of counseling, when I came back, he was asleep in a bunk looking like he hadn't slept in months. And they got the idea that I was documenting every time they weren't counseling people. So his counseling was scribbled on a piece of paper and the NCO threw in his face and continued on throughout his day. And that soldier, unfortunately, I wasn't able to help him and time he's alive, but because of how much stress and trauma he got heart palpitations at 22 years old and got discharged from the service and has to have an internal pacemaker for the rest of his life at 22 years old. When I came back from Iraq and Kuwait, I thought that the leadership had done everything they could, but finally on my last day, the night before I set to come home, they brought me into the office and told me my promotion to a sergeant was going to be denied. All my schooling that I was going to go to was going to be denied. And I'm telling them, I'm documenting all of this. And they said, go ahead, because they knew that the inspector generals I was reporting it to were all for going after a lower ranking NCO, but the Army doesn't like to try people of a higher rank, especially it's different with the Guard because it's a smaller unit. Most of these people have grown up together for 20 years. It's not like the Army where you got people coming all around in your unit from Alaska, Hawaii, and most of the state's National Guards. It's people growing up in the same jurisdiction. And so I knew that was a thing, but I figured the Army couldn't fail at that level, and I was wrong. Three years later, they asked me if I wanted to pin it all on one guy, akin to how they did it for the first time, and I said no. Everyone I put in that report was clearly guilty. I'm not going to put it all on one guy. And the investigator said okay. And 2 days later, I got an email saying all my evidence was deemed inconclusive. I say that, and I don't necessarily regret putting in all the reports that I did. If I had to go back and do it again, I would. The experiences in Iraq, once I left, though, it left me akin to my father. There was like a piece of me gone. I was disillusioned by the Guard. I figured I was going to spend the last 4 years of my time in the Guard just hanging out, not going on missions like everyone else. I managed to switch to a different unit that luckily didn't have anyone that I deployed with, and so I was able to stay under the wire, so to speak. But I knew my mental health state was, I couldn't tell it at the time, but as I was later told by my family, my mental health state was deteriorating. I was quick to anger, not necessarily prone to violence, but they later told me that they noticed I never smiled again. I kept a stern expression when before I was always joyful. And so I picked an employment to do while I was in school that allows you to be stern, joyless, and angry. And I was picked up within 2 weeks by the TSA. Let that sink in. I think Lonnie got it. So within 3 weeks, I was hired by the TSA. I had all the military clearances, so it was a quick turnaround. And within 4 months, I was trained and at the Epley Airfield in Omaha, patting people down, being openly called a dick, and just generally wasn't really fazed by anything. I wasn't necessarily openly rude to people, but I also I was monotone, joyless, usually quick to annoyance with people. I gave them an attitude. And the thing was, I was really good at my job, and so I never got in trouble for it. But there was even times where managers would pull me off. They're like, hey, you're doing great work. Maybe you could just be a little bit nicer to people. And you do the old, oh yeah, I get it. And you just never change. It wasn't until 9 months in that when I met my then girlfriend at work, now spouse, 2 years later, that I realized just how far down I had come. I hadn't smiled in like 9 months. And when I started dating her, I came to work one day and people were shocked and they were like, Jacob, what's wrong? And I had no idea what they're talking about. I was like, what do you mean? I'm healthy and fine. And they're like, well, this is the first time we've seen you smile in 9 months. And that was a wake up call to me of, was I really in this deep of a hole? And I thought, it's hard to do self-reflection. I thought myself was fine, But these people are my coworkers who have worked with me are telling me that I haven't smiled in 9 months. I mean, that's kind of a not a good way to go about your day. So my wife and I got married quickly. We got a house in Papillion. And then the guard gave me a, similar to my first deployment, they gave me a phone call, look at the news. I guess he's still president. President Donald Trump was on the news saying about how the border is being overrun by drugs and other, whatever other excuses he was. And they were like, look at the news, you're being mobilized in 2 weeks to Arizona. So I was like, okay. My wife and I moved to Tucson. And I was familiar with the term fake news. I thought the arguments that Border Patrol were putting children in cages was that fake news. And my first day on a Border Patrol compound, I watched some children getting escorted to cages. I was like, what the fuck is going on here? It was not fake news, like they said. My mission there was for 4 to 5 months. And I was sitting in this camera room overlooking the border, watching all these illicit activities occur. The groups of families were being detained while all the Border Patrol agents were dealing with that. I would show on the camera the actual criminals, like people with felonies and people walking around with assault rifles, would go up the mountains 20 miles to the north because they knew the administration was more focused on the women and children, and not the people 20 miles north actually walking in that are an actual threat. This was indicated because one of the people they managed to capture from these groups, not the family group, from the groups walking north, they were very lax on watching them. And within 10 minutes on a bus, he managed to knock down a guard, escape the bus, go to a nearby restaurant, hold up the restaurant staff with a knife. And I got that phone call from the restaurant saying there's a man in here in our kitchen with a broken leg. And I told him, yeah, they told me what he looked like. And I said, yeah, that guy was just arrested for Border Patrol and he worked for the cartel in Mexico, stabbing pregnant woman. And within 2 minutes, he had the restaurant staff held up at knife point. So it was difficult for me to deal with that mission because Iraq was clear cut to me. There were nothing ISIL was doing was good. But with this mission, the administration was focused on dealing with women and children who only crimes were wanting to have a better life for them and their families while ignoring the true threats. My breaking point on the mission came from, and how I discovered the EU was, we were tasked with dealing with the most heinous of criminals who were leaving food and water on the paths of the border for people in the desert to not die. And what we were doing is we would point the camera at these people, call the forest patrol, who would give these people a ticket. And the ticket was just a fine, but the Trump administration found some loophole that said if you got like a certain number of tickets, it's the way they used to arrest Henry Thoreau, if you're familiar with civil disobedience. They give him a certain number of tickets and then arrest him. They did the same thing with these people leaving food and water. They would give them enough tickets for littering on a federal park and then arrest them. And after participating in this, I got the name No Los Muertes. So I started researching and wanting to learn more about what this group was about. And it led me to a UU congregation in Tucson. If any of you have been to Tucson, that congregation there, that's every congregation for the UU faith has a certain niche they're responsible for. It's usually geographic. The Tucson's niche is that No Los Muertes. I hadn't been in a church in 3 years, but when I first walked in the front row, I saw an LGBT couple openly sitting next to each other in hands. I saw a Sheikh family. A traditional Sheikh family sitting in the front row. I saw quite diversity and welcoming, and I fell in love with the environment. My wife and I did. And the first sermon we went there was actually from one of these people from the No Los Muertes group talking about how one of their numbers had just been arrested by federal police and what they're going to do about it. And I realized I couldn't participate in this no more. I completely disagreed with it. So I put in my request to leave. I spoke with the Tucson minister, told them everything that I had done and what I did. And they said, you know what, like, you recognize what they were doing was wrong, and you, of your own accord, decided to voluntarily leave this mission. I mean, it took a lot for me to leave that mission. And I was just so inspired by the work that they did. And I had had the chaplaincy thing in the back of my head for my experiences in Iraq, because I noticed numerous times when I was putting in reports that they were getting ignored, not because they were considered invalid, but because I was a specialist. Most people don't care about lower enlisted. And so I decided the best way for me to go about helping soldiers while being part of the EU faith was to pursue this military chaplaincy. And that my experiences with Iraq has served as a reference for me throughout my ministry. And it's been, the last 2 years has been a journey. Like I said, it might've been the first time in 9 months I smiled at TSA, but that trauma, especially from Iraq, was still there. When I first interviewed with the EUA and the Star King School for the Ministry and the Chaplaincy Institute, all of them said, we love your packet, we love your background, but you need to get some help. They weren't saying that as a dig at me. They were just giving me the reality. So for 9 months, I finished 4 months ago, but I managed to get some help at the combat. They had me go to the VA Combat Trauma Center, which I hadn't had any combat trauma per se, but the counselor that was working with me said that my eyes were fluttering akin to some POW Vietnam veterans he was working with when I was discussing the trauma. He said, even though I wasn't a prisoner of war per se, in my mind, I was basically being a prisoner of my own consciousness. I was denying that I was feeling fine when I clearly wasn't. I share all this not because I want people to feel sorry for me. It's just, I want to show that I don't necessarily follow the traditional path of ministry. I grew up in a religious environment, but it wasn't a part of my life per se. I left the faith kind of officially when I was 18. Even now the Army says I'm Protestant, but I still don't know necessarily whether I believe in God or not. But I do know one thing is that I believe in man. I believe in us. I believe in all that we're able to accomplish. I believe that even now there are members of our military service who don't know it, have never read the Constitution they swear to uphold. Otherwise they would never do the actions they do. Even in my time in the Oregon National Guard, I've been seeing things that are like, what the hell are you doing? I've pulled people off to the side and say, okay, you can't do this. Just because someone told you a year ago you could do that, like this, you can't be doing this. And now, when if me pursuing military chaplaincy, that's going to be that expectation of me is the Army only requires two things out of chaplains: to give services on Sunday for whatever faith the Army says you are. The Army says I'm Protestant, so that's the faith they want me to give on Sunday sermons, and then keep track of soldier morale. So 2 hours of the week I give a Protestant sermon, that leaves the other six hours and 26 days and 22 hours of ministering to soldiers on whatever needs they are. I mean, keeping track of soldier morale isn't just buying them pizza. Keeping track of soldier morale is witnessing them being sexually harassed by an NCO, and instead of laughing it off, pulling that NCO off to the side and say, get, pack your things up and leave. And that's I've been recently learning more about in the public safety field that 2020 has brought in what's being called the accountability era, where we're holding law enforcement and other individuals accountable for their actions. And with the military, I think that's how I'm viewing my work, what I want to do as a military chaplaincy. It's this accountability era. We've had 40 to 50 years of time and time again of soldiers from all branches of service, all deployments, even today, reporting that they were sexually assaulted, sexually harassed. There was a female senator who I read even last year openly on the floor of Congress describing how she was similar to me. She was coaxed and coached by one of her officers until she got raped by him 4 months in. It's it's not an isolated incident. It's been proven time and time again that it's still occurring. And it's not that people aren't aware that it's going on. It's that no one wants to hold these people accountable. And the military chaplains play a key role in this accountability. They wear a rank on their chest, but they're not in the traditional chain of command per se. They operate kind of outside all chain of commands. They can do whatever it takes to ensure soldier morale. And if that includes holding people accountable, I mean, they're expected. And are the UUA, for their military chaplains, they even hold a higher standard in the bylaws. They say, if we think you're not doing your job well enough, they'll remove your certification, which if you get your certification removed as a chaplain, that means you can no longer work as a military chaplain. And so it's basically a de facto getting kicked out of the service. The Army can hold chaplains accountable for wrongdoing, but it's like a 2-year process where the UUA can do it overnight. With that, I suppose, can we bring up the UU values?
Yeah, I'm getting myself together here.
Oh, you're fine. I've got them up.
No, I have them, Jacob. It's just very powerful, your words. Hold on.
I remember seeing these principles when I first walked into the Tucson congregation, and I didn't know what they meant. I didn't even know what the principles were. I didn't know that it meant the UUA as a whole. I thought this was just like Tucson's kind of guidance. But I remember reading this. I scanned through all of the first principle, I mean, all the other principles, but I remember the first words, the inherent worth and dignity of every person. I was there on a mission in Tucson, completely disagreeing with that the administration was taking the inherent worth and dignity of every person. When I joined the Army, I had swore to uphold the Constitution, which, if anyone's read the Constitution, it says something along the lines of everyone's welcome in this country. I think our Statue of Liberty, before they took the sign down on Ellis Island, used to say something along the lines of all are welcome here. Give me your cold, you're tired, you're hungry. And yet, here we had a current administration that was openly putting children in cages, which, if anyone's familiar with childhood trauma, that's going to be detrimental to their upbringing of being thrown into a steel iron cage at the age of 6 and 8 and separated from their family. I was really inspired by the risk the UU of Tucson was putting themselves by upholding this principle, because though the people were getting fined and arrested for putting these food and water supplies, I don't think anyone at that first meeting I went to said anything along the lines of stopping. If anything, the response seemed to be, we just need to send more people. They can't arrest us all. With that, my take on it is exactly that. It's we recognize and we know that every person has dignity and worth, but we also know that there are times where people might not view that. It might not be safe for us to help those, but we have proven time and time again, our faith, such as the Tucson congregation or even our history of civil disobedience and protest, of when we know it's wrong, we know it's wrong. And sticking up for all of humanity, regardless of their faith, gender, socioeconomic class, age, sexual preference, that's what we are. I view this principle as what defines this faith, that all are welcome here, regardless of their faith background. And I've seen this past fall, we got to do some Wiccan services at our congregation that I particularly love. And I mean, there is no single doctrine for us. The second principle, justice, equity, compassion, human relations. I think this compassion piece is the key. We can all recognize our differences, whether it's political views or which ocean is better, or whether SoCal is better than Oregon. And we all have these differences. Some people might be openly wrong, but having this compassion in our human relations is what defines our UU values. It's being able to have these civil discourses, being able to come to a neutral arbitration. I mean, even if any of you were in the chat room for the word's slipping me, the UA gathering this summer, there are some open hostilities in the chat room by senior reverends, but they still came together at the end and apologized. I mean, that's what recognizing your wrong, acting compassionately towards each other. The third principle, acceptance of one another and encouragement to spiritual growth in our congregations. And the Corvallis congregation during my time there, I work as a youth advisor for them, a volunteer. The spiritual growth is something the UA takes very serious. In our training for youth advisors, they straight up said, like, if a youth expresses interest in another faith to you, help them get the resources they need. Even though the UUA would like people to stay within the UU faith, we recognize that people need to, that they're going to grow through their own accord. If we don't offer them that, then they're going to go find it elsewhere, and it might not be as conducive as if we provide them the resources. During my time, I've seen two youth convert to Buddhism, one converted to Catholicism, and one converted to Baha'i. And this wasn't us egging them on. All we did was we practice all worldly spiritual practices, and the youth would be like, I really like this practice, and just stick with it. And it's a wonderful thing that the UU allows. A free and responsible search for truth and meaning. I think this, when I was interviewing with the chaplaincy board for the Army, I respect them, but as you're aware, many of them are 65-year-old Southern Baptists and don't truly understand what the UU faith means. And so they were like, okay, I get that the UU is interfaith. So are you a Buddhist UU or a Christian UU? And I was like, whoa. Back you up there, because they couldn't understand the Army viewed the responsible search for truth and meaning of, well, how can you be a chaplain if you don't already know what the truth of the world is? And I was like, I asked one of them point blank. I was like, have you died before? And he said, no. And I was like, well, how are you 100% sure on what the truth is? And he didn't say anything after that. It's just like this free and responsible search for truth and meaning. None of us knows what 100% sure what happens when we go, or where, how the universe originated from. I mean, even the Big Bang Theory, we don't know. It's like the question of the turtles all the way down. We don't know what came from before the Big Bang. And so this free and responsible search for truth and meaning, allowing us to come to our own truths, but still being part of the congregation, it's such a wonderful acceptance. And I'm glad that our congregation participated in it. The right of conscience and the use of democratic process within our congregation and society at large. I think this principle is what ensures the longevity of our faith. There are many faith traditions and we can see the early Christian church and the Nicene creeds, where there's only one power person in charge that says, this is what we're going to do, this is what's going to happen, and no one's allowed to question it. Well, many of those faiths we've seen, the Catholic Church was able to keep that up for 1500 years until something called the 30 Years' War happened. And now we've got, I lost track after 30 different Christian branches. We've got Protestant, Lutheran, Baptist. I mean, having this democratic process within the congregations ensures that we can have disagreements on policies, we can have disagreements on moving forward, but I don't think any congregation has questioned these principles. If anything, many congregations have advocated for adding more principles to this. I saw that at the local gathering this summer. But being able to have that vote and have that voice ensures that it doesn't feel like just one person's in charge. I mean, this is a faith for all of humanity, so therefore all of humanity should have a voice. The goal of world community with peace, liberty, and justice for all. Well, I think many of my instructors and some of the staff actually took a bit of leave to go around their communities and support of the new president coming in. And I think that goal was met, because even though it was a 3 million vote difference, I think all of our door-to-door knocking EU representatives did in rural areas such as Georgia and rural areas of California helped get the votes needed to push that over the edge. And it just aligns with our goals of this world peace, world liberty. And during my time in Tucson, I was inspired by many of the local activists who, while on top of the other things they were advocating for, animal husbandry practices seems to be well advocated for. And I was inspired by the UU coffee hour. I really liked the vegetarian dishes. I never had vegetarian food before. And so for the last 2 years, I've been a practicing vegetarian now. And all it took was that UU coffee hour. I'm sure no one intended to convert me there on the spot, but that was some good quiche. Let's see. Respect for interdependent web of all existence of which we are part. I view the first principle as the most important, but I think the seventh principle is just a given on how we continue to operate and how our faith continues to grow while many faiths across the world are still in a global decline. That respect part is the key. We recognize that we all come from different backgrounds and different faiths, and we might speak different languages, we might have different hair colors, we might have different football team favorites, but we're still in this interdependent web. We don't know what the web is per se, but we all know that we're on this planet together. Something brought us here together. We're still moving forward together. We can go isolate ourselves in the forest or wherever, but we're still dependent on each other, especially with how connected our globe was. I had the privilege of taking a supply chain course during my undergrad. And it was just funny to see how a delay in Brazil could affect something all the way in Russia. And we're no longer isolated species. We're a global tribe at this point. And this continuing this respect instead of hate is what's going to ensure our longevity of our faith. And I think we've already proven that time and time again with standing up for LGBT rights, standing up for rights of other faiths, standing up for rights of soldiers. And it's just that the respect thing is the most important thing I can think of that will help ensure our longevity.
That's all. Wow. Thank you, Jacob. That was very heartfelt and profound. And I appreciate your being so candid and honest with us about your, not only your personal journey, but your spiritual journey and how it led you to our denomination. I'm very grateful for that.
There was one thing I forgot. I was going to share it in the biography, but Lonnie told me to save it towards the end. But after all the buildup over the last 2 years, the Army Chaplaincy Board, they put a question mark on my document and then just stamped an approval. And so the next month I'm going to be promoted as a second lieutenant chaplain candidate within the National Guard. So while I'm in schooling, I'll be able to work under a full-time chaplain and serve soldiers and go through the relevant training and experience.
Yay. That's awesome. Congratulations.
Absolutely. I can't thank you. I just can't thank you enough, Jacob. I know we're getting near our time and we have about 5 minutes for questions, but what I think it really helps this community to understand, which we understand personally, because we may have family members, but to understand a group, be that group that whatever group is marginalized, the oppression that happens in the soul and for us to not expect smiles and, you know, rust arms and, oh, thank you for your help you use in the community. You know, I mean, that you really put into perspective that for me, you know, it takes time to heal. And this was really unbelievable. But we do have about 5 minutes. And what were you about to say?
I was just going to say that we have about 5 minutes if people want to stay on and ask questions. I was looking at the chat room, and I think, Jacob, you may have seen this, but one of our members has just made a donation in your name to Star King. So congratulations.
Thank you so much, Leonor. I'm deeply humbled by that.
Yeah, well, and it shows your skill at telling a story.
Thank you.
Which I suspect will only grow and mature as you do in your new profession. So thank you.
All right, Ray has a question.
Yes, thank you for your biography and your comments on the seven principles. I'm very supportive and agree with principles 2 through 7, but I have a problem with number 1. I have difficulty viewing Adolf Hitler or Charlie Manson or many others as having any worth and dignity. Could you comment on that?
I've examined that issue before on, it's like, I think I took a philosophy course one time that said, if you had the opportunity, would you go back and kill baby Hitler? It was like, that was like the second question of the class. And it was so difficult for me on, are the value is clear on the inherent worth and dignity of every person. And I think this, our fifth principle is the counteraction to that. And many of us are familiar with the Gadfly papers and how there were some words in that paper where we disagreed with, and the congregations as a whole came together and said, no, this is not all right. Our faith has proven time and time again that it disagrees with issues and incidents, and many of these come from things people do. And so with the Hitler comment, if we view it as the number 5 of, we recognize Hitler is killing people unlawfully, unmorally, and the congregations say, okay, stop doing that or else, and he continues to do that, then 1 goes out the window because he's already proven that he's not going to listen to the faith. He's going to disagree from all values and he's openly doing it. And it's similar to the Gadfly papers, that congregation agreed that some of the wording was wrong and seeked forgiveness and closure. And I think that initial action is wrong, but seeking that closure, forgiveness, I mean, it's similar to the Christian faith of repentance. It's not necessarily that it makes what they did right, but it shows that they're trying to rebuild and change of what they've done.
Jacob, before we go, I really want to just give the words to Lucinda and Dave. They've got Caden that's doing service right now. He's our precious guy, you know, grown up in this church, and some words to those parents, you know, because they're worried, you know, we're all worried about him. Could you just chat with them in our final minutes here? Some chaplaincy practice here.
Okay. For which
Lucinda,
person?
Lucinda, wave your hand. Lucinda, wave your hand. It's Lucinda and Dave.
Our son, we talked at the beginning, our son's on a deployment. And thank you, Lonnie, for recognizing him. Yes, we are very worried. And Jacob, I can't say how much I appreciate sharing your story, candidly and honestly sharing your struggles. And thank you.
And I'll add that, yes, we are, you know, very worried about Caden and going into harm's way potentially. But me personally, I mean, I worry more about not so much he's going to end up in combat as just, you know, the other challenges, you know, like you've suffered.
Abuse.
And, you know, just the whole environment, culture,
hostilities
that he might be suffering outside of, you know, actually being in, you know, a combat situation. So, you know, we don't know what he'll be like when he comes back.
Yeah, no, I appreciate the sharing of your son's story, and I can tell that he's entering an environment right now where we're pulling out troops and every day another city in Afghanistan is being lost. I mean, it's not in a cool down period right now. And as a Marine, the Marines, that's their entire goal, is they are our nation's front line, so to speak. They have been at every major conflict in the past 80 years and have done the most been the most involved. I mean, there's a saying where the Marines fight battles and the Army wins wars, because the Army just has all the resources. They bring it in, where the Marines are usually left of their own accord, forced to rely on that brotherhood and sisterhood that they have shared and bonded and agreed with. I mean, the word Semper Fi, always faithful, it's not just a saying, it's not just a Latin translation, it's in their bones, it's ingrained from the start. And they're sitting on that ship. The ship isn't there to transport them to safety. They're there for the safety of the ship and all those weapon systems, and they're there to keep soldiers' morales high, because the Marines are taught from day one that not only are they responsible for their brothers and compatriots, they're responsible for all brothers in arms. And I know that your son is entering an environment right now that is prone to risk and unpredictable, but with the sheer amount of resources that he's going to have with him in regards to his fellow Marines, fellow service members, the soldiers under his command, the other units, I think the deployment itself, with the way they're doing the mission planning, I think he's going to be safe. I really do. I don't see the current administration rushing him in unnecessarily. And it's not that I don't think he will answer this call when called upon, but the unfortunate reality is, even if he's not necessarily thrown to the front line, he's going to see a lot of trauma. During the last withdrawal of Iraq, I remember my father said, just seeing the look on people's faces and bawling over their child that was just killed because they left an area with no more security and the Taliban just came right in. I think he's going to see a lot of things that he wished he wouldn't have seen. And I'm sorry, but that's just the way it's going to be. Is we can't control what he's going to see in the next coming months as the Afghan government battles a force that has been using U.S. forces to battle for the last 20 years and hasn't been able to hold its own in some time. He's going to be responsible for the aftermath. A lot of those Navy ships are off the coast, not to fight the fight. They're there to bring people for emergency medical evacuation. He's going to see a lot of blood. He's going to see a lot of trauma. He's going to see a lot of missing arms. He's going to see a lot of missing limbs. And I don't know how upfront he's going to be with what he's seen. That's just the deployment for him has already started. He's trained for this. His mind is ready. But I think the after effect is it's going to be a while before that switches off. So I would say during the deployment, the best thing you can do to support is allow him to be upfront during the day. Ask him general questions like, how'd your day go? I wouldn't try to push more details than that. And I wouldn't be too worried if he goes a couple of days without answering. It's not generally just because of lack of internet service. Sometimes when you see traumatic events, even though he's been under your care for his whole life, they don't want to call their family members immediately because they don't want to give them that trauma. They want to try to hold all the trauma in. It's just a natural human response. Care packages are great.
Okay. Oh, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Please continue.
That's incredible. Cordell,
in care packages. I thought I'd like to hear the rest of that sentence. Okay. Sounded important.
Yeah. No, care packages are greatly appreciated. The Marines love their Rippets. You can buy them at Dollar Tree and Dollar General. They're little energy drinks and king-size candy bars. The Army ships things in closed containers. The heat will not melt it completely, but they're hard to get overseas. And just recognize that for him, the deployment is 9 months and he comes home. But for you guys, the deployment is going to begin now and about a year after the deployment. It's not going to end for you guys. You're going to need to keep tabs on him. Just let him come out of his shell. The first 3 months, he's probably going to be held up in his room playing Xbox. It's just a common response. The new PS5 and Xbox One just dropped. Xbox just dropped. So just allow that to happen and just let him come out slowly over time. And it might be 2 to 3 years before he shares with everything he's seen, but just recognize when he feels comfortable enough to share, that means he's finally on the process of healing. The healing's not going to begin right when he comes home. It's going to be about a year after the deployment.
Thank you. And good for all of us too. You know, it here in our church to make sure, and maybe we'll get together with you, Jacob and Lucinda and Dave, to talk about a care packages that we send out, you know, from our church.
I would be fine to share with that.
I'd also like to suggest that when he comes home and when he's ready, that maybe depending on what's going on with COVID, but we might be able to find a way to have a social distance thing outside in the park where we can like welcome him back. And I'm getting this idea from a show I saw about Native American warriors, that when they come back from deployment, like at the Comanche community, they get together and the elders and all of the veterans, people have been veterans as Comanches, get together and they do a dance. Well, obviously that's not, you know, our culture, but the important thing was, is that both when they were deployed, there was a dance and they were sent off with the blessings of their community. And when they came back, no matter how they were feeling, they were welcomed back and held in the arms of the community and let the person know that they're still there for them.
Thank you, Anne. I think that would be really meaningful. Michelle did lead our family in a beautiful blessing ceremony before he deployed at the church on the patio, just our family because of COVID. And it was meaningful for us. And I think it was meaningful for Caden, even though he said he was just doing it for us. But I think it was very meaningful for him. And I think some acknowledgement when he returns would be really meaningful. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Oh, my friends, I am so sorry. We have services starting at 11. I've never apologized for services starting at 11. Jacob has just been unbelievable. It is a music service. A worship service, if you're, you know, inclined to, on our homepage at uucb.org, you can just click the link that says Facebook or YouTube to watch some music. You have changed me. I'm sure you have, you know, changed others here, and we will be following your chaplaincy and your advice on how to be a congregation more loving and supportive of our military brothers and sisters and family.
Thank you. I appreciate getting to share with you guys, and hopefully sometime in the next year or so I can give another check-in. Lucinda, I hope you guys are well, and hopefully we can come together and get some support items for your son.
Thank you, Jacob.
Thank you.
All right.
Thank you, Jacob.
Fabulous presentation. Thank you so much.
Thank you.